Hi, this is Steve Gilmore, and this is the Gilmore Gang, an abbreviated edition because we ran into some technical problems at the top. And I just wanted to say that our guests today are Danny Sullivan of Search Engine Land, Saul Hansel, formerly the New York Times and now the program director, well, we'll find out from him, of AOL's Seed.com, Andrew Keen of Andrew Keen fame, and Kevin Marks. I want to thank in advance the sponsors of this show, which is Rackspace, so without whom, and especially with Rob Legess's help, this entire edition of the Gilmore Gang would not exist. And also the TriCaster folks at NewTek, without whose TriCaster this show would also not exist, at least not on video. So I want to thank you, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks.
We're not designed to try to have you come to our front page every day and see what's happening. We understand that our articles are going to be distributed through Google News, through TechMeme, through any number of portals, and you know we're pulling you in through the different back doors. Maybe there's a combination of the two types of things that happen, but
That's old, right? I mean, at this point, I don't know what Search Engine Land's stats are, but even the New York Times had, you know, 90% of the people who came in sideways. And it made people crazy, but it's
like Tiger Woods, right?
And, and you know, 10% of the people, the New York Times has a front page product, which is a successful product, but people now can disassociate their front page, you know, your aggregation experience from your content experience. TechMeme is only a front page. So I could go to the front page of CNET or the front page of TechMeme, and they each have their advantages. We have, you know, the homepage of AOL.com is a very successful product for a certain audience, and people like it. It's not a majority of the people, but there are millions and millions of people who like it, and I think we should actually take that. In fact, there's a lot of work to invent other kinds of front pages for people who want front pages and other kinds of content for people who want content, and if they want the bundle, they can have the bundle, but they don't have to have the bundle in this world, right?
Have you gotten Google to pick you up as a news source in Google News for Seed?
Well, Seed is not a consumer-facing site. Seed is our factory, right?
But I mean, the articles feeds with these other sites, right?
No, the other sites, like I know Engadget and other ones will be in there, but when I was looking at Seed, there's actual articles that are in there. So do they consider it a news source?
Seed has no articles.
Seed is how they commission the articles.
No, Seed is just a factory. Is a source. Seed is just, all Seed really is an alternate way to communicate with freelancers. All of our sites have freelancers already, and they've communicated by email and telephone, and they've had to sign a paper contract. Now we have just automated the back-end workflow to let them get paid by PayPal or automated transfer, to pick up assignments through this eBay-like interface, but everything else is the same. The sites are the same sites we've always had that have all been picked up by Google News and are distributed to the same audience.
So I'm
coming to Seed to take an assignment.
Categories. There's news and politics, there's tech, and there's arts and entertainment, a bunch of different areas of assignments. There seem to be no assignments in tech and only two in news and politics. Is that because the editors of those sections are actually commissioning pieces from journalists they already know? And is just the fluffy stuff you're commissioning through Seed? Is that why it looks a bit trivial?
Seed isn't a transition, right? When it was first started, before they, you know, had me and other people thinking it through, they created one assignment format. And the way it worked, instead of submitting clips and resumes and having to prove your experience level, they said, we're going to run it like a contest. We're going to put up assignments. Everybody's going to submit. We'll buy the best one. That turned out to be not the best for either reporters or editors in a lot of circumstances. The editors had to go through a lot of stuff. The reporters didn't want to write when their odds of being accepted were low. If they were any good, it felt demeaning. It's a perfectly good format for a couple of cases. We're redoing the technology. If the South by Southwest project is really the first one where it's using more of what I call an RFT model. We ask who wants to cover something, people can write us, we pick one person, they get one assignment. So yes, the answer right now, we are in between technology formats, and so at this particular moment, the volume's low. AOL just went through a staff cut. There's a bunch of stuff. We're just starting out. You know, we've been up for 2 months. It says beta for a reason. Some people say beta as marketing. We say beta because we're working the bugs out.
Okay.
So what do we give it then? If this was the, if we were doing an analysis as a panel, what do we give this new AOL thing out of 10? I give it 3.5.
Well, you really need to give it, look at the sites. Are the sites serving their audience?
I did look at it.
Not C.
No,
I still give it 3.5.
Limit drop into silence, right? And if we are helping them by covering some more things and the sites get a little bit better, then we're helping them a little bit. If we can help them in large volume, which is our goal, then that would be better. And if we dilute it and we take sites that you love and suddenly you stop loving them because the quality has gone down or they're about boring things, that's when you should downgrade us.
Well, I didn't downgrade you. I always gave you 3.5.
So I'm looking at the spinner.com assignment for the South by Southwest music thing.
Yep.
And it says, fill in this form here. Actually, it doesn't even say fill in the form. It says write an email with things. It's a step back down from that. But it doesn't say which bands would you actually like to interview, which is really strange because if I'm going to South by Southwest, it's because I care about music and because there will probably be some bands I want to go and see. So you're going to assign a random band that I've never heard of that I'm supposed to interview. This just seems a bit strange.
Just to be clear, the interviews were meant to help people at the conference, so we're doing them by telephone in advance.
No, I get that. But the assignment process is not looking for fans of the bands to interview them. It's saying, we'll give you a random band and you can talk to them.
We are doing this very fast, and what's actually happening is if you do one and we like it, and we'll come back to you and say, would you like another one? And at that point, you can ask for the bands that you want. But most of the bands are ones that people haven't heard of. The top 100 bands, which are the ones that people have heard of, we're giving to our professional staff, right? Because we want to make sure that the content is the best, and so the top bands are going to be interviewed by people who've been doing this full time for their life, and all the new bands, which you've never heard of and nobody has, that's why they're at South By, we're going to have an interview with them when nobody else has anything about these guys other than their MySpace page, and we're adding value to the world. If you read the comments we're getting from creators, they're really enjoying doing this. This is an opportunity that people haven't had. Almost everybody's asking to do a second one. That's another indicator that we have. I mean, we're going to go back and we're going to survey them, and we're going to try and really understand what we're doing and how people like it. I want to have people having a good time with this, right? But I need to make mistakes. If you sit there and get all the answers...
No, I'm just, right?
If we aren't making big, bold mistakes, we're never going to accomplish anything, right?
Right.
If we're not risking your ridicule, if everything was buttoned up, I know we were going to fail.
Yes.
You sound like a startup guy, but you're part of a real company. This is what's so weird about this. Is this a huge company that... Wait a minute. Is this huge company that clearly doesn't know what it wants to be when it grows up? It's already grown up about 7 times. And you sound like someone who's just got their first round of $50,000.
I take that as a compliment.
Well, I don't mean it as one.
I think that lots of companies, and AOL turns 25 in about a month, you know, get stuck in what they're doing. I actually think AOL's strength, Steve Case's strength, was turning on a dime, right? He went from a per-minute business model with rev share to content creators to a flat fee model where the content creators paid him for distribution, you know, in 6 months. And both of those models were the right one for their time. He made a bunch of things that, you know, that people will call mistakes. Other things happened. It was not a good story for the last 10 years. But a little bit of flexibility in a pretty dynamic market doesn't seem like a bad thing. And I think there's a lot of energy to try and do cool stuff.
Danny Sullivan. Danny, do you see any kind of relationship between AOL story and Microsoft?
In terms of Microsoft trying to succeed in search or just in general?
Did a real good job for, 15 years, 10 years ago, and then stopped doing a really good job.
You know, part of me feels like AOL's better days are long behind it. It brought a lot of people out onto the internet. Well, first of all, it just brought a lot of people online. It was within the walled garden of AOL, but still it was online and gave people a taste of what, you know, the web was later going to provide and did provide. And then I think that, you know, they were this safe way to get online, and then they just kind of became outdated. It's like you didn't really need them anymore, and they dropped the subscriber services. And right now, they just seem to be going through this refining themselves and remaking themselves process. And in some ways, it may be that you have to disconnect the fact that they may be a 25-year-old company, but they may really just be a one-year-old company. You know, that they're starting out again from scratch. And what we're going to see from AOL now may be just radically different from what we're used to having them in the past.
Right. Now, flip that around. Do you see Microsoft as being a one-year-old company?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, in search, which is what I cover the most, I think you could say that Bing really was them kind of starting off from scratch in a lot of ways, and they got some deep pockets to go behind it. But, you know, if you looked at Bing and looked at it as if it were a one-year company coming into the space, yeah, they are much more successful with it. So, yeah, I think that could be a fair enough analogy.
And what about the, you know, they invented the tablet 10 years ago.
They did.
And now it's been reinvented by Steve Jobs, and at least in my opinion, far more successfully.
Well, so we could then say, okay, well, we got the iPad and it's all written off, but, you know, this is... So here's my MacBook, which died, right? And I've been successfully using this for the past 2 years, and it died 2 weeks ago, and I moved off to it because I'd had enough with Vista, and everybody I knew was using Macs, and I could still run Windows programs on the Macs, and it looked like that, you know, that's the way everybody was going to be going. And here I am 2 years onward, and while still lots of people are using the Macintosh, Windows is still the dominant thing that's out there. And in fact, I'm using Windows 7, and it is very, very nice. It works really well. I don't have any problems going between that and the Mac. I like some of the hardware things on the Mac, but I don't think, oh, I could never get by with this other computer. So I think that Microsoft has a lot of power and a lot of potential, and even if they didn't get the tablet right the first time, it doesn't mean that they can't get the tablet right if it becomes more popularized through Apple. You know, I think they've got a much bigger challenge. They've been trying to do the same thing with the Zune, and it doesn't seem like the Zune has really taken off. Now they're trying to bring the Windows mobile phone back and with the new edition and see how that goes. And I don't know, I think that's going to be a harder thing to do, but you also look at people who get frustrated with Apple. Hi, I'm Apple. We can't have sex apps because we don't want our store to look bad, even though people may want that anyway. And hi, I'm Apple. I want to control this and I want to control that. And so to some degree, they can tap into the seesaw that happens. And I certainly wouldn't write them off.
Oh, sorry, Andrew. I had you shut off so you could rustle your papers and have your dog bark. Go ahead. You were saying?
I think, you know, you really are being now the Hegel of Daily City by making the connection between AOL and Microsoft, because it is a very
interesting... Oh, yeah, that's a real reach. I mean, come on. What are you talking about?
You know what I'm talking about.
Sad to say, Microsoft makes a little bit more money and can, you know, put many more billions into building and buying a search engine.
Yeah, but, you know, Apple has got... they're piling up a lot of cash. They're coming to the marketplace with what I consider to be, you know, a transcendent device, which is going to change how everybody uses their computers from here on out, and Microsoft is busy playing catch up.
But no, can I ask you a serious question here? Now, really,
of course,
because all my questions are serious. What is financing this? I mean, I had lunch with someone in New York a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about AOL. And they said their core business is still the dial-up business. I mean, is all this content stuff being financed by the little old lady in Omaha who's still paying $9.99 to get telephone connectivity?
That is still a profitable business. I forget the number.
But is that what's still driving? Just as Microsoft is, you know, the Bing thing, or the billions on Bing.
Please don't use my analogy,
financed.
Andrew. Don't use my analogy after shooting.
Okay, I won't use your analogy. I use my own analogy. Is Is AOL financing this content thing through its core dial-up business?
To some extent, absolutely. And wouldn't you, if you had a business that was declining, wouldn't you use whatever profits you made from that to go build something new?
No, I'm not.
Yes.
No, I'm not. Criticizing. I'm just trying to make sense of what's happening here.
You were criticizing. You were suggesting you gave it a 3.
But that's different. I criticize the business. What I'm curious about, I don't think it works. It still doesn't convince me.
Let me just ask you this question, though. Right. So I think the analogy, Steve's analogy, makes some sense, right? So clearly, you know, in 1999, both AOL and Microsoft were a lot more powerful in their respective markets than either of them is today, right? So that's true. AOL has had sort of a bigger slide, unfortunately, but that's the story. Here's what's different, right? When you say, okay, who's Microsoft competing with? Apple on one side and Google on the other. And those guys are just doing great. They have powerful, profitable businesses, market value, consumers who love them. If you say there is a content business, right? People are going to write stuff. Who are we competing with? Who is the Apple of journalism? Who's the Google of journalism that we are competing with? There's lots of good people. I mean, the New York Times does a wonderful thing, but they're struggling with some issues. I think they're going to be fine. Who's doing better? Who has a better chance than we do to take advantage of the media and technology market of the future to help inform people?
Demand on the one end, and then the New York Times on the other extreme, right? And everyone else in between.
So, everybody together, do you think that demand by itself and the New York Times by itself, without either using the methods of the other, will end up doing better than somebody who may have some of the strengths of both?
It's hard to do everything, though. I think that's the problem.
Well, you know, take that and switch it over to Google versus Apple. There are two different models for it. One is a closed, highly designed, and sophisticated, appealing to an elite audience that keeps buying upgrades, and then you've got Google, which is a we just lost Danny, I think.
Oh no, can you hear me?
Yeah, no, it's okay. We had a test pattern, which was interesting. And then you've got Google, which has an iterative cloud-based software over the wire or over the air upgrading model based on advertising, and the two of them look completely different, but they're both converging into the same model. They're both going to do it all. So, I mean, I guess I'm rejecting Andrew's thesis that you can't do it all. I think that the successful companies who have enough ability to be able to finance inroads into the competitors' architecture, they in fact can do it all, and they'll both be successful. Anybody want to comment on that? Danny?
I'll go out on a limb, yeah. I don't know. I don't know that if you're trying to do it all that you're going to be successful as if you focus on one particular thing. I think if you look at AOL, for example, I think Engadget is successful because they focus on gadgets and consumer technology and stuff like that. And I think that if they tried to go broader than that, they wouldn't be as successful. I think that when you look at something like the New York Times, they're successful, and I think they are successful in that, you know, their job is to be a place for people who want any kind of general news that's provided that's out there. And I don't know. I think when you start trying to get too many things, yes, you can lose focus, and you can possibly start having problems where you're trying to figure out how everything's reinforcing everything else. I guess that doesn't mean that I think that, you know, demand media is going to go away or demand media is going to eat it all. I think everything will find its own different place. But yeah, I do
what
tend to think.
What is demand media? I never heard of it.
Well, demand media is a service. They're primarily known for eHow, and they've taken a very algorithmic approach towards producing content that they can tell people are searching for and that they can tell that they can monetize. So they've got sophisticated tools that'll tell them, hey, we've had this many people who we can tell are searching for information about X topic, and we know that we can make this amount of money off of that topic if we had some content, especially content that started ranking on the search engine. So somebody go out there and write an article about how to fix your toilet. Or how to fix this, or how to fix that. So they produce all this kind of content, and they're known as a content farm because you're almost like planting giant crops of content. Sometimes they're great crops, sometimes the crops aren't so good. That's the big criticism that
And
they
how
have.
Do people find this content?
Through Google and the miracle of Google taking you to good content. I mean, that's one of their primary ways that they get traffic is that they try to produce this content that's out there, and then they hope that it starts ranking well in Google. And
so
it sends them
these are the people that actually click on the Google links.
These are people who do searches at Google
yeah,
and click.
I've heard of them. Have you ever met anybody who clicks on a Google link?
Only on the ads, and they all work for Google.
But the stunning thing about demand is how little they pay. What is it, Danny? They pay, is it $5 for a 500-word piece? It's like slavery.
I mean, that's actually been one of the nice things about AOL is they actually seem to be hiring good journalists who no longer have jobs and paying them a little bit more than a few pennies per piece that they're producing. But that's what something that worries a lot of people, and that's what we've been seeing a continuation of with the internet. You've got photographers that are in the same boat. I can't remember the case that came up, but I think it was Time Magazine or one of the big news weeklies that had commissioned a photo that they bought off a stock photography site for like $75. And you had these professional photographers who would be making thousands off of it saying, what are you doing? And so we're going through this big, huge change where a lot of creativity and a lot of creative content, a lot of news reporting content is, you know, suddenly getting very, very devalued. I'm hopeful that that's going to change. I'm hopeful, actually, that places that light demand that are just too factory-driven aren't going to succeed against places that have some degree of passion to them, that have people who are writing not just because, well, I don't have another job and I've got nothing to do, or this was just the assignment that I was given, but because I'm trying to create something to an audience and I'm trying to create a place for people to learn, I'm trying to make people to get good material that's out there. And I think that's why you look at some of the successes and all the blogs that have been out there. I think Engadget is a great example of that, where you've had it get started by people and you have writers that have a lot of passion that's involved with it. And hopefully over time, enough people will be going to them that they can be paying more of a premium to their writers.
You look, I have, for my entire career up to 2 months ago, earned my living entirely by writing. And so I identify enormously with people who earn a living from writing. But at the end of the day, I believe that you can't wish that the world were like the way you want it to be. You have to take the world as it is and then do what you can. I could say I'm the world's best travel agent, but essentially travel agents have been replaced by a web interface. They aren't needed. The internet is changing the rules. It is lowering the pay for lots of people, and we've got to figure out what to do. The supply and demand are going to adjust. There is more supply of content. People are spreading their interest out over more different points because they can. And so we've got to say two things. One, how can we make the most interesting things possible with the money that the market gives us? Not with the money we wish that it would give us, but with however much money we can make from ads or fees or whatever. That's our budget. And if we can make stuff that people like for less than that, we can stay in business, and otherwise we go out of business. The second thing, though, is we owe it to our readers to make happy creators, right? I've got to figure out how to scale the assignments to get the right people to do them and to make them efficient to do. So if I can bundle five of the same assignments to somebody so they can do five at once because it takes less time than doing five completely different things, or otherwise make, you know, use some of that automation, my search. If a part, for example, of doing an assignment is doing a web search, if I can pre-do the search and hand it to somebody so they can more efficiently look at the search and write whatever I need them to do or whatever it is. The more I can make their job efficient for them to do where they really add value, the better they're going to do for me and the better they're going to do for themselves. You know, what you
but
have
if,
to
if you take, it is. But if you take the eHow example and demands example, what I'm not trying to say, oh, I wish it were, things should be this old way and it was great when everybody's paid that way. Although I am saying that. I mean, I do think that writers and quality writers should be paid a living, that they should be able to be successful in the writing that they're doing, that they shouldn't have to be getting pennies here or there. And
Hollywood
what I
makes
think,
that case in the record industry makes the case in Congress, and if we could take that case to Congress and say all writers should have X amount of pay, you know, as a writer, I think that's great.
The record business didn't make that case.
Yeah, but what I'm saying may happen is you have eHow, for example, realizing, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to generate this money, and we're going to do all these kinds of assignments. But what I'm hopeful is that you actually get some smart writers who look at this and say, you know what, I've just done these 20 assignments in this month, and I've managed to make all of $1,000. I'm going to stop doing this for somebody else, and I'm going to do this on my own site, because
well, that's what you do.
I've got tools that make it easy for me to put all this stuff up, put all the ads up there, and wow, I've just written the 20 stories now, and I've made $2,000, or I've made $3,000.
Right, I think that's really the thing that I see coming with the iPad. And I'm using the iPad as just a generic term for what this type of device, because we'll see one from Google and we'll see one from Microsoft if we haven't already, is the ability to be able to put yourself, nail yourself up as a contender in this information space. For a little more than a lot of work and time on your part. I mean, with cloud computing, there's virtually no cost. You can do a very sophisticated site up on Amazon or whatever for $70 a month or something like that, even less. How do you compete?
Clearly, there's going to be a lot of that, although, and this is a debate we have internally, I think that the process of journalism is more than just an atomized bit of content, right? There's a relationship between a writer, often an editor, an audience, other writers on the same publication or creators, and often but not always, the sum is more, you know, the whole is more than the sum of the parts. But only where that's true does that ecosystem matter. One of the things that we can do at AOL, I hope, is you're sitting there working for Engadget and you discover a trend. You can do what the New York Times did very well, which is I say, this is bigger than just my job covering cell phones, and you rewrite it for a mass audience or you get the permission and the space to do the investigation. The process of being in the field learning stuff, out there talking to people, where you get smarter every day, is a process that leads in lots of directions. And one of the things we have to do, we do a little bit now and we're going to have to do a lot more, is draw from that, from the people. We've already started hiring people from Seed and making them columnists and giving them regular contracts. For us to succeed, we have to make the whole ecosystem smart and draw the intelligence of the reporters and the engineers into all the places where it could be useful.
All right, I want to switch gears just a little bit,
yep,
because we're going to run a little long today because of some technical problems we had at the beginning of the show. So,
AOL the sponsor of this? They just got 2 hours of free.
You know,
free abuse. Yes,
I've been trying to get
free
Saul.
Abuse.
Exactly. When Saul, yes. When I finally caught Saul, the only reason he's on today is because there's a massive snow day in New York. Number one, because, you know, as by his accounting, he is always wrapped up in endlessly boring meetings in his new job. So I welcome the opportunity to have him do as much of a commercial as he wants. But when he did, when we spoke today, he keeps saying about how he's going to get all this, he welcomes all this abuse. So now I know what he was talking about.
He knows, he gets it from everyone.
Well, but
what are the... So yeah, what do your ex-colleagues on the Times think about this?
Andrew, one of your, just so you understand, a lot of your early abuse on this show will not be on the on-demand version of the show. So if you want to repeat some of those insights, now's your time. But your question was about what is the New York Times colleagues, what do they think about
your
job?
Like, you know, the media guy, what does he think about what you're doing?
He wrote a column on demand, you know,
Saw that, yeah.
I don't know the answer to that question. I actually had a little
Why did you leave? I still don't really understand. It seems mysterious to me.
I'll tell you why I left. I left because I spent 15 years watching people build things and be creative, and it was a great job. I loved every single minute of it, but I was in the front row seat. I wasn't on stage. I wasn't building something. And so I think that, you know, it's not guaranteed, but I think AOL, with Tim leading it, has as good a chance as anybody in building something that we all can be very proud of 10 years from now that are going to really help people and help solve some of the problems of journalism. And if we're going to fail, I'm going to have a good time trying, and I'm going to, you know, work really hard. And if it's a very different life. Everything about my life is different except the ultimate mission of helping people learn about their world.
Kevin, why did you leave Google?
He was fired.
Same kind of idea. I mean, I left Google because I felt that I'd done a lot of the stuff I was trying to do there, and I wanted to try and do something different, because I didn't feel that the stuff I wanted to experiment with was going to get supported there. I'm recognizing this, you know, being at BT. There's some parallels there. Sure, BT has a lot of revenue from selling wireline telephony in the UK, and that revenue is shrinking. But it's also getting a bunch of revenue from other sources too. And part of the challenge is saying, as this revenue source goes down, how do we find another one that's going up? And that's part of the interesting part of reinventing telephony here, and saying, okay, there are all these people out on the web who have devices. How can we provide telephony services to them, even though they don't happen to be in the UK and wired into the ground? That's interesting, and it's something that you can use the money from the old part of the business to invest in the new businesses. And I think that's something that is entirely possible. So that I have some sympathy for the AOL approach there, in some cases it's easier to be, in a slightly different business that realizes that Google is in the business of making money from search advertising. That is, you know, a huge preponderance of the revenue they make. They are making some revenue from other things, and you know, it adds up to $1 billion or so. So yeah, it's a significant business. But that is the dominant thing that they think about, and that's their, you know, their source of revenue. So that does drive a lot of what they do.
So I wanted to switch the subject just a little bit and talk about or hear your guys' thoughts on. And by the way, the sound in the background is the entire Pacific Ocean coming through my studio window. I wanted to know what you think about this sort of shrill environment that we have right now, characterized by Dave Weiner's paranoia or leadership role in saving us from the big companies and, you know, patents, you know, the whole thing with Google and Google Buzz taking over our digital lives and privacy. And I want to start with Danny on this. You know, I've seen you've written about some of these issues. I'm not sure how they relate to search, but you seem to have broadened your perspective to include other issues. Do you think that this is paranoia justified, or to put it in the terms of the kinds of things we've been talking about content, do you think it's just boring content?
No, I mean, I have some of my own paranoia. I mean, I've spoken before that I feel like suddenly I've become squeezed between Google and Apple and Microsoft, and I'm running around wondering who's my underdog or who's my safe haven.
Suddenly? I mean, it's always been like this.
Well,
I mean, it just used to be Microsoft and nobody else. I mean, if anything, there is so much more choice now than there has ever been.
I guess, like, if you look at Apple, for example, I always saw Microsoft as very dominant, and dominant in a lot of the software applications. And then, to me, Apple was out there, but it wasn't that serious of a player. for me personally. And then, honestly, when Apple started coming along with the iPhone, that's when I felt like things especially really changed for them. Mm-hmm. I know that they had a big, huge change in terms of what was going on with the iPods themselves, but the iPhone wasn't just for playing music. The iPhone was for actually accessing the internet and accessing information, and it got turned into an almost de facto standard where you almost felt like you had to have it. So in some ways, it was nice that Google had stepped up with Android, and you thought, wow, there is an alternative. I don't have to just have the iPhone, even if I still find that the iPhone's a bit better.
Right. But, so why
alternative has to come from Google, which I'm thinking, really, do I really want to be connected to Google on my phone when I'm already connected with them on so many other things as well? Why couldn't it be Palm?
But isn't it possible that once you get up above two major vendors, that the kinds of dynamics that have, you know, plagued us with a sort of a monoculture in the past no longer have the same relevance? I mean, I just somehow feel like it's the sort of the founding fathers arguing about whether or not we're going to throw a tea party or not, about incremental developments of large corporations with business models that are going to be successful and which are going to get a lot of customers, and, you know, that the noise around this woe be all of us because we've given these companies too much power. I mean,
it's not incremental, and I think what's happening is that these companies that used to be much more contained in particular areas have grown, and they're almost turning into our auto manufacturing facilities, where we're going to have our GMs or our Fords or our Toyotas, and this is going to be them. I mean, Google was a search engine, and they provided search, and suddenly they turned into providing ads all over the web, and then they were providing the ability to host your documents and your spreadsheets, and now your phones, and now your freaking operating system. All this is coming from Google. There's no end to what Google wants to do. Google wants to be this ad technology company, and it'll do whatever the heck it wants. And if you go over and you look at Apple, I mean, Apple used to make computers. They still make the computers, but then they evolved into the music devices, and then they evolved into the iPhone, and they evolved into the iPad. And as part of making the music, suddenly they're cutting music deals. Suddenly they're almost like a content provider or a content gateway. And we're seeing the same thing happening with e-books, right? I mean, they have enough power, Apple, that they don't even have the e-reader live, and yet they managed to cause Amazon, which has had an e-reader for much longer and has actually been a player in the book space much, much longer than Apple, to have to turn around and renegotiate and redo all the deals it wanted to be doing. I mean, that's an amazing turnabout from a company that was supposed to be building computers. That's what they were supposed to be, a computer company, right? They're not that anymore. I don't quite know what they are, but they're not just a technology company. They're not just a hardware company. And you've got Microsoft over here.
They said they're a portable device company. Their new pitch from Apple was, we're a portable device company, or something like that. There was some like phrasing that they had, which basically says, we're building things that that are iPhones and iPods and iPads, oh, and computers too, and we're focusing on things that people carry about. And that was their, you know, that was their way of expanding their category to cover more realms, which they did very well.
So I'll jump in on this. Sure.
Well, you know, this is the sort of debate that has been going on throughout American history, because there have been people against the banks or the syndicates or whatever, and for good reason sometimes, and there have been economic conditions that have led to centralization of industries, you know, since, you know, John D. Rockefeller put together all the oil companies. And so it's the same debate, and the same arguments on both sides essentially are true, right? How bad is it that a handful of companies make most of our, you name it, food, transportation, cars, communications? You know, it leads to higher prices, lower choices, but we have oligopolistic competition, so there's some innovation. It's not my issue, but I'm not dismissing the people who care about it, and I believe in good antitrust policy and good, you know, structural policy to help people compete fairly. I think some of what Julius Genachowski is doing at the FCC will end up being good to create, you know, some sort of open playing fields. I'm not terrified about Google. I think they've been able to compete with Microsoft. You know, they have undercut Microsoft's monopoly at least as much as they have made their own. I think that most of these companies earn what their centralization, even Microsoft, which did some illegal bad things, that was on the margin. If they didn't do any of the things they got in trouble for, they would still have exactly the same market share of Office and Windows. They, you know, they earned that with their customers because the customers wanted standardization. They were the best standard around, et cetera, et cetera. But then again, look, I went from the New York Times, which is establishment, to AOL, which is big or something, right, even if it's a startup. So that's my take on the world.
All right. Andrew, and we're going to wind it up after this because I know several of us have to move on. I'm going, by the way, to see David Sanborn tonight in at Yoshi's in Oakland. He's got a great new record, and I hope you listen to it. Andrew?
So, what was the question?
The question was, are you bored by this incessant ranting on the part of Internet founding fathers about the dangers of being overwhelmed by a two- or three- or four-horse race for consumers getting free content and free information and being able to even jump on themselves and become content generators?
Well, you may remember I wrote a book about this.
Yeah, but you've denied most of it. So what part of your next book is going to...
Not publicly. So where have I denied it?
So in other words, you think that it was an interesting topic 4 years ago and that it's been beaten to death since then, right?
I mean, I've talked a lot about it, so it's hard for me to get that excited. I definitely think that this comes... Actually, Saul disproves my argument, unfortunately, because I like to think that large companies are innovative. I'm not convinced AOL is very innovative, but I think Google's quite innovative. Apple is clearly innovative. I mean, my theory about innovation is it comes from authoritarian characters. That's the interesting thing about Jobs. It's what makes Apple successful, is because he's highly authoritarian. So I'm not sure if it's got to do with the size of the company. It has to do with the size of the ego of the person in charge. The bigger the ego, the more authority, the more people fear that person, the more likely they are to innovate.
I don't think that's true at all. I think, it's sure the only progress is made by an unreasonable man. You can argue that one. But if you have someone who has sort of massive dictatorial power, they can make stupid decisions and choke lots of stuff off. Apple has choked off a lot of stuff. There were a lot of interesting things that didn't ship when I was there because it was decided, no, we're not doing that, and there wasn't a way to go around that. Now, yeah, they have focus. They're focused on the hardware and the devices, and they're good at that. But to say that's the way they innovate, that isn't, you know, that doesn't work so well. The thing that Google does is they try and do lots of things in parallel. They try and say, okay, we want to contain the universe and have lots of things going on at once, and that ends up being very chaotic. In case people say, well, why are you launching Wave and Buzz and this and that and that, and it's like, we don't know which one's going to work. We'll chuck a bunch of them out there and see which one fits. And in some respects, it's because they have the chance to do that because they're doing software. When Apple has to make a decision, they've got to set up a production line in China and build a whole bunch of physical things and ship them around the world and get that stuff right. So that's their focus of their business. Whereas Google is in the business of being able to do lots of things in parallel and see which ones stick and trying to simulate a startup culture within the company.
But that's that's also where Google is running all these different things, not just because they're a startup culture, but it's because there's nobody in charge. They don't have somebody who's sitting up there saying, right, this is our master plan. I am Steve Jobs, and I have decided that we're going to do these sorts of things, and I'm going to fine-tune all these products. They've got people doing all sorts of different things. And stuff comes out of the woodworks where sometimes they don't even expect it to happen. Buzz is a great example of that. Buzz had nothing to do with Wave. Completely different products, completely different teams. The fact that they seem very similar is much more coincidental than anything else. And then the Buzz people don't even seem to understand what it was that they had created or how they were stepping on everybody else's products that were out there. Apple could have never produced Buzz, for better or for worse. They would never have produced a product that was so rough on the edges and that was so messed up.
But it's for worse, man. Wouldn't you say, Danny, that it's for worse? I mean, if Apple would never have had a situation where they had Buzz and Wave running in parallel when it wasn't clear what the difference was.
Apple might have launched a product that didn't take up and buzz because of the way they just pushed it out there and they shoved it in everybody's Gmail accounts actually got some good pickup.
Has it taken up though? Is Buzz for real?
To me, it seemed to have dropped down in the past week or so. So whether it's going to hang on there or not, I don't know. It still has a long way to go if it's going to get there. But, you know, they had activity. They had people going. When I was running searches to find what people were saying on Buzz, I was surprised that you actually had people saying anything at all. Like, I could do searches on the Olympics, and I could see people were posting right within their Buzz accounts to talk about things that were happening out on the Olympics. So, yeah, I think that they actually did come out with a credible alternative to Facebook and to Twitter in the status space. And, in fact, they've done that before and more successfully at this point than either Yahoo or Microsoft have, which are the people that they're competing with. Whether it's going to stick, we'll see.
And I mean, in fairness to AOL, because I think this show has really been about AOL. I mean, Armstrong came in, and he clearly, I'm not sure I'm convinced by his strategy, but he clearly has purpose, and he's reshaping the company accordingly.
Sure.
Okay,
disagree with that.
I'm going to leave it there. Sure. This is Steve Gilmore. I want to thank Danny Sullivan. I want to thank Andrew Keen. I want to thank Saul Hansel. I want to thank Kevin Marks. I want to thank Robert Scoble for being on a plane so that he couldn't attend the show. I want to thank everybody who showed up, and especially those who didn't. We'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye. For